This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Steed protests. At 11 on Between the Covers, the guest is Emma Donahue, author of the acclaimed novel Room and the new collection of short stories Astray. And at 11, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. That's all coming up, but first at 9, Press Watch features New Year's predictions based on news you're not supposed to know. That's all coming up with Teresa Mitchell right after this.
Hi, this is Joanne Hardesty. Join me on Thursday, January 17th from 8 to 9 for a conversation with City Commissioner Amanda Fritz. What are her priorities for this new term? What are your questions for her? Please join me on Thursday, January 17th from 8 to 9 for Voices from the Edge on KBOO.FM Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Q Center Winter Gala, Fire and Ice. Fire and Ice will be held at Castaway Portland, 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue, on Saturday, January 26th. The VIP party begins at 6 p.m. and general admission is at 7. Entertainment includes a performance by two-time Grammy Award winner Matt Albert and much more. Information about the Q Center Winter Gala can be found at kboo.fm/2013fireandice.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and examination of the news you're not supposed to know. These days, when you see different weather, you always wonder, don't you? It's like, is global warming driving this? And in a, you know, incremental way, I'm sure that's always the case. I got up this morning and opened the door and I thought, it's snowballing. My dog stopped short and looked at the, you know what I'm talking about, clumps of snow coming down. And it was interesting to look at, and it's not freezing and it's not sticking. I'm talking about the Portland metro area, and have a little furry cat that always goes out before she checks to see what the weather is. So I thought, well, this will be fun. I open the door and shoo shoo, the cat runs out there. And sure enough, after getting pelted a few times, she looks up and gets that kitty cat look that tells you the cat's astounded. So it was snowballing, and it has been snowballing off and on. Headlines today: swine flu and avian flu are on the march in Great Britain, Egypt, and the U.S. Recombinomics.com reports 18 H3N2 deaths in Pennsylvania last couple of weeks, with around 500 hospitalizations. The Falun Gong newspaper Epoch Time writes that last season's deadly swine flu has resurfaced in the U.K. this winter. They write, the illness has caused at least 45 deaths as of January 5th, according to the UK's Health Protection Agency. However, the full extent of the disease grasp might be grossly underreported, according to a commentary published Monday by Recombinomics. Many other deaths, Recombinomics says, presumed to be common flu or pneumonia might actually be undiagnosed cases of H1N1 or swine flu. The HPA, that is the Health Protection Agency, officially reports that there have been a total of 135 cases of H1N1 so far this season, including the 45 deaths. Some UK hospitals are reporting being overwhelmed by flu cases. In two hospitals in Worcestershire alone, there were 58 flu patients admitted as of January 7th, with 15 people in critical condition. However, according to Recombinomics, the Health Protection Agency's figures are not credible and are likely missing a host of people, mostly young people, who have fallen ill but have not sought medical treatment because they assume that they have ordinary flu, a chest infection, or other non-life-threatening condition. And continuing with the Falun Gong article, in one anecdotal case cited by Recombinomics, Keith Ingham, a 50-year-old man from Exeter in southwest England, unexpectedly died in his car after complaining of a chest infection. Quoting, "We all spent a nice family Christmas together at my sister's, and the last time we were together, all together, was Boxing Day. I remember him saying he had flu-like symptoms, but he thought it was just a chest infection and didn't bother going to the doctors." His youngest daughter, Carrie, 27, told This Is Devon newspaper. An autopsy concluded, according to the paper, that he died from natural causes. It was believed he was suffering from pneumonia. Recombinomics says the case is illustrative of classical H1N1 fatality involving an adult under 65 who develops flu-like symptoms followed by pneumonia and death. And, of course, this is the reason why I'm bringing all this up. The H1N1 epidemic or pandemic in 2009 was grotesquely misreported. And so I've learned to repeat the real news about that that experience in the following way. During a time in which no or very few flu deaths were expected, in other words, not during flu season, from the summer to the fall, 10,000 people died in the United States. And if 10,000 people had died from a terrorist attack, then we'd still be hearing about it in the newsreel. But this was 10,000 people who died while the media was poo-pooing the whole situation and saying that it was just nothing, and ironically blaming the media, saying that it had been overblown. Well, it wasn't overblown for those people who lost a teenager or a baby or their husband. And this is what you should know about H1N1. Certain varieties attack very quickly. They strip out the lungs and are swiftly followed by a secondary infection. Usually, overstepping my bounds, I should say frequently, pneumonia, probably pneumococcus in any event, frequently a very severe infection. So you get sick, you feel wheezy, you feel short of breath, you think maybe you're just getting over it, then suddenly you get much, much worse. And you should see the doctor. You should trust yourself. If you feel like you're really going down, it's time to see the doctor. And if you have influenza, then you may need antibiotics. Now, you may have heard pharmaceutical manufacturers and other health concerns have been, well, rightly saying that if you misuse antibiotics, and by this they mean, although they don't make it clear in the ads, I think, they mean if the general population misuses antibiotics, then, the bugs get used to it, and it makes things worse. It causes mutations, evolution, actually. Don't like to say that word to Americans, evolution, which causes stronger, more drug-resistant bacteria to arise. However, if you have had the flu and you are getting or about to get pneumonia, then yes, you really do need antibiotics. They can save your life. And I speak from personal experience. This is Press Watch. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And this is my my prediction show. And so I have one very easy prediction. This is going to be a bad flu year. There is much more information about the flu situation. It did hit the newsreel. Funny thing, after I decided that this is news you're not supposed to know, now it's news that you can easily know, so I'll just include it anyway, though. CNN has an interesting article saying flu picks up steam across the U.S., and they have a map. And if you look at the map, you can see that Oregon is one of the red-marked states, not the worst, but definitely flu is happening. Moderate flu activity. And they also mentioned that there have been several flu deaths. They write, since October 1st, there have been 700 confirmed influenza cases among Boston residents. And in Massachusetts, one of the 29 states that the CDC has identified as having high activity of influenza-like illness, the mayor declared a public health emergency in the city because of the flu. So this is something you should take seriously. You should take precautions to keep your hands washed and clean. You can get some of that alcohol-based hand sanitizer, that sort of thing. I've had good luck so far using colloidal silver. When my nose, when you get that feeling in your nose and you know you're getting some sort of rhinovirus, something that starts in your nasal passages, well, I've used that to pretty good effect, pretty much immediate effect. Now, speaking of illness, it's come out that U.S. sailors have been sickened by the Fukushima plume. They were on the USS Ronald Reagan. Some of them are now suing. Here's a quote from Energy News. A lot of us, this is from a sailor, a lot of us knew people were getting sick. Some were starting to get bad headaches. Some threw up a bit. And she said she's also battled exhaustion and poor health. At one point, she lost clumps of hair. And my comment on that would be that's a very typical radiation reaction. She said last June, severe back pain revealed a bulge in her spine. And she commented that she was a healthy, healthy person. And she's not the same person she used to be. And that's on ENE News. com. So this brings me to another prediction for the new year. We will hear more about the health crisis in Japan and beyond from the Fukushima disaster. And that's just because a lot of these illnesses take time to show up in the statistics. And also it takes certain forms and certain levels of dosage of radiation a while to start having their worst effects. And my prediction is this year, we'll hear more about it, even though the Japanese, like Americans, turn to denial first when it comes to a matter of national security or of national, well, of corporate interest, really. But enough of that for right now. Here is news from South Texas, actually from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reports on January 8th. Let's see, this is the 10th, so that was 2 days ago. A failure of the Unit 2 main transformer occurred, which resulted in a Unit 2 automatic trip. We're talking about the nuclear reactors at the South Texas nuclear plant. The failure of the main transformer, they write, resulted in a fire and damage to the transformer. The on-site fire brigade responded to the fire. The fire was declared under control and declared out at 16:56 Central Standard Time. No off-site assistance was required, so it was just a few minutes, they say, that they had the fire. An unusual event was declared for initiating condition HU2, fire explosion in protected area or switchyard, which affects normal plant operations due to the main transformer fire. And they write, due to the site electrical lineup at the time, the loss of the main transformer resulted in loss of power to 4160 ESF buses, blah, blah, blah. And translation, well, let me read a little bit more. All three motor-driven and steam-driven auxiliary feed water pumps started as required. The main steam isolation valves were closed in accordance to procedure to limit plant cool down. Decay heat is being removed via auxiliary feed water with steam generator power operated relief valves. So let me translate all that gobbledygook. The South Texas nuclear power plant had a fire this week. Emergency procedures were initiated to keep it from going kablooey. And they worked. Isn't that good? I didn't think so either. Predictions. This is the year, as I said, the health problems get bad in Japan, and I would say that the financial system isn't very healthy either. And to that effect, I would direct your attention to an article by Bill Frezza in Huffington Post, The Two Big to Fail Banks Gamble with Bernanke Bucks. And as you might expect, it's about derivatives. But the article, Frezza writes in the article, as Congress and the President wallow in finger-pointing and fiscal gridlock, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke plows ahead with his plan to disguise the country's economic ills by carpet-bombing us with freshly printed money. aided and abetted by the gnomes in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who are doing their best to convince us that inflation remains at historic lows, Ben has promised to conjure up $1 trillion a year out of thin air until unemployment returns to a politically acceptable 6.5%. And this is my comment. $1 trillion? Yes, $1 trillion a year. And returning to the article, where is all this new fiat currency going, and why haven't we seen it show up in double-digit inflation? The answer should frighten you. The narrative being promoted in Washington is that Helicopter Ben's money is being loaned to businesses so that they can expand and hire more people. Oh yeah, and it's also supposed to finance cut-rate mortgages to help stabilize the housing market. Achieving both of these goals will supposedly goose up aggregate demand, the magic elixir that purportedly makes economies grow. Mainstream journalists who blithely call a reduction in the rate of growth of government spending a budget cut dutifully parrot the party line. It's a great story except for one problem. There's no evidence it is true. According to the astute number crunchers at Zero Hedge, total issuance of commercial loans since September of 2008 has gone down by $120 billion. Think about it. Who wants to lend money when the government artificially sets inflation-adjusted interest rates below zero? Spend 2 minutes in the real world and you can see the consequences for yourself. At a recent meeting between a local banker and a client, the banker complained that there, and it was a client of mine, Bill Frezza writes, complained that there are now 10 checkers for every person in the loan department. Compliance paperwork has become so burdensome and risk aversion so high that only corporations that don't need loans can get them. As a result, small businesses, the classic engine for job growth, go begging while Fortune 500 companies park record levels of cash on the sidelines. Yes, mortgage rates have hit rock bottom, but underwriting standards have gone through the roof. And he writes, my wife and I, she's a doctor, I'm a venture capitalist, recently refinanced the mortgage on our condo. It took 3 months to get approval, despite the fact the loan amount was for less than 30% of the condo's appraised value, and we have perfect credit scores and no other debt. And this only after we provided every bit of documentation short of proctology exams. What chance does a first-time home buyer have in a market like this? And I want to depart from that text and comment generally, perhaps you have been trying to sell your home, and you've heard that, oh, well, houses are selling. And then you find out, golly, your house is just not selling. Why is that? Well, the houses are selling. Perhaps the question is, who are the houses being sold to? And the fact is, the financial elite are snapping up houses. They're snapping them up as investments. They don't intend to live in them. They intend to rent them for as high a rate as they can possibly get. And if you can possibly do it, I would recommend that you rent your house right now rather than sell, because how are you going to compete with banks? And they would really prefer to buy what they call distressed property, that is, something that's already been foreclosed on that they can get a bargain basement rate. They don't want to pay you a fair amount for your house, and they're just about the only ones buying because of the aforementioned situation in which you really just can't get a loan. The people who are buying the houses have money up front, and well, that's life under the billionaires. Returning to the article, so where is Ben's money actually going? The data shows it's being stuffed into the balance sheets of the too big to fail banks, some of which only became banks overnight when their brokerage businesses faced imminent collapse. Recapitalizing these banks after their housing market malinvestments and the crash of their derivatives casino, the inevitable outcome of Alan Greenspan's money printing to fuel Fannie Mae's doomsday machine has been the principal goal of both the Bush and Obama administrations. With the boundaries between Goldman Sachs, Treasury, the Fed, and the administration virtually disappearing, the big banks, Democratic and Republican handmaidens running interference, and the media distracted while pursuing pissant stories about debit card fees, consumer protection rules, and shareholder gadfly proxy access, all is hunky-dory and too-big-to-fail land. But what happens to all that freshly printed money after it gets parked on a bank balance sheet if it's not loaned to businesses and consumers? Perhaps we could sleep at night if it just sat there as a cushion against the recession that lies ahead. But unfortunately, the banks appear to have flocked back to the derivatives casino, confident that the officially recognized too-big-to-fail institutions they are free to privatize gains, as too-big-to-fail they are free to privatize gains, gorging on bonuses while the sun shines, knowing they can socialize their inevitable losses. And here again, I would like to make my own comments. This gets to my Swami-like prediction for 2013. We're headed for a crash. And the reason we're headed for a crash is because we accepted bogus remedies for the previous crash. No, not cash crash, the previous crash. And nothing has changed. The Dodd-Frank bill did not replace Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall is what was spiked under the Clinton administration and led to this whole gigantic derivatives casino. And I would like to point out that the derivatives casino is, at this point, in monetary terms, somewhere near $1 quadrillion. Yeah, $1 quadrillion. And these are debts that cannot be paid and therefore will not be paid. When you talk to a bankster about this, the first thing they say is that, oh, that's notional value. Of course, $1 quadrillion doesn't exist. The global economy has maybe some tens of trillions of dollars in it. It does not have $1 quadrillion in it. And even if those tens of trillions are not available, that's part of world economies and corporate economies, and is not available to pay debts. Now, and the first thing a bankster will tell you is that, well, that's notional value, and actually they don't have to be paid at full value, or maybe not even half of full value. So let me bring that up again. The world does not have half of $1 quadrillion. The world does not have $0.1 quadrillion to pay these derivatives debts. And these, and so we have, in the meantime, we have this nonsense in which the very casual, ordinary, and historically insignificant raising of the debt ceiling is now being used as a political football by the billionaires using their Republicans as proxies. And they intend to hold up and shake up the government and shake the financial ground as much as they can, trying to get what they really want, which is the billionaire's agenda, which is to say that you stay miserable. That's very important. You cannot have billionaires without people being miserable. It is not a coincidence that we see slavery and billionaires exploding into the news at the same time. The billionaires need slavery. The reason being, that's how you aggregate that much wealth. At this point in history, we have sufficient advancement of technology and technological infrastructure that we should all be relatively wealthy, all of us. There is no difficulty, given our technological structure, in appropriately distributing equitable ratios of land and food and useful work and that sort of thing. That's not a problem. The problem is, well, billionaires. And so at this point, the crash of 08 is still with us, basically. If you look at a metric called the Baltic Index, you'll see that commercial activity is still at a very low level compared to 2007 and 2008. And that means that there really hasn't been a recovery. It means that everything has been kept in place by Helicopter Ben's creation of free money. And he intends to continue doing this under the Obama administration. And basically, because it is so hard to imagine the consequences of a complete financial crash, we're all encouraged to pretend that it's not coming. But here's my Swami-like prediction. It's coming, and I think this year. Returning to the article, banks are supposed to be chartered to take in deposits and use them to make loans. Under the magic of fractional reserve banking, only a percentage of the deposited money needs to be retained as steady reserves, ready reserves, while the rest is put to work in the real economy. And here we have a banking system that for the first time in history has $2 trillion more in deposits than outstanding loans. If you think that makes the banks less vulnerable to shock, think again. Much of this balance sheet cash has been hypothecated in the repo market. And I'll explain that in a minute. Don't get afraid. Laundered through the off-the-books shadow banking system. This allows the proprietary trading desk at these banks, and that word is this is just one of those mornings. It's in quotation marks. Banks. To use that cash as collateral to take out loans to gamble with. In a process called hyper-hypothecation, this pledged collateral gets pyramided, creating a ticking time bomb ready to go kablooey when the next panic comes around. They don't call it gambling, they call it hedging, which is a legitimate function, investment function, but of course it is gambling. And so I used some terms here. I used the repo market and I used hyper-hypothecation. And these are terms about buying and selling propositions of gambling. To back this up, I have another article, and this is also by Frezza, and it's called The Hyper-Hypothecation Credit Default Swap Time Bomb. And it starts this way. Hey, Bill, lend me $1,000, would you? John, under normal circumstances, that would be fine, but you've been out of work for months. How are you going to pay me back? No worries. Sam owes me $1,000. As soon as he pays me, I'll pay you. But Sam is an incorrigible drunk. I know, but Charlie promised to pay Sam $1,000 as soon as he sobers up. Who's Charlie? Multiply those numbers by a billion and change the names to Lehman, Merrill, Goldman, and AIG, and you get a picture of what happens when Wall Street's credit default swap house of cards tumble down on Fannie Mae's collapsed subprime mortgage cesspool. When financial markets froze up, policymakers saw bailing out the lot as a lesser of two evils, notwithstanding the moral hazard this created by signaling to the financial masters of the universe they could get away with disregarding counterparty risk. Much more to that article. You can find that at realclearmarkets.com. And once again, to the point, the reason this is significant is because we are facing financial collapse, and it is inevitable. Because we have allowed this billionaire class, these banksters, to play in their own way. And one of the reasons that they get away with it is because we allow them to intimidate them. They use their terms like repo and hyper-hypothecation. And the press generally, I'm going to get a little sharp with the press here, I guess, by which I mean the corporate-owned press, either doesn't bother to find out what all that really means, or just doesn't understand and goes along with it. So we are talking about gambling, and this is not really a new thing. I mean, this happened during the reign of George III when they were attempting to hold the American colonies. People liked to gamble. There was an excessively rich superclass who believed that their time was best spent gambling, and that's what most people did. They gambled about everything, took wagers on everything, and just had a tremendous amount of pride in doing so, winning and ruining their own estates. And gambling is what is happening. Derivatives are gambling, and we allow it to happen. Why? I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but of course, the banking class has bought off the government. We have a fully owned government. You're listening to Press Watch. Now, coming up, Linda Olsen Osterlund, and much more information for you. And I thank you for staying tuned to KBOO Portland. You've been listening to Press Watch, and once again, my predictions for the coming year: financial collapse, a really bad flu season, and much more from Japan about the health crisis. Stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine and Linda Olsen Osterlund coming right up.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO and A Deeper Look. I'm your host, Linda Olson-Osterlund. Our topic today is the war in Afghanistan, a failure on all fronts. My guest is Dr. Zahir Wahab. It is my great pleasure to have Dr. Wahab join me in the studio. I've heard him on KBOO interviews for many years over the past decade. I've called in and asked for KBOO to have him on again soon because I appreciate his expertise. Professor Wahab was born in Afghanistan. He began his educational journey there, going on to receive a BA from the American University in Beirut. He went on to earn a master's degree from Columbia University, I think a master's and a PhD from Stanford, the first Afghani to achieve that honor, the PhD. But he found a home here in Oregon at Lewis and Clark Graduate School of Education, where he worked for over 40 years, only retiring this past August. And he helped design literally scores of courses there and deliver them, took students to many international study opportunities abroad, and was really is a very beloved professor there. But his educational journey didn't stay in those areas. It went full circle, and he's been back in Afghanistan for the last decade working very hard on educating educators and on the whole effort for literacy there. And when he retired, he didn't retire. He just went on to do more of that activity and get more time there. So it's really my great pleasure to have you in the studio. Welcome to KBOO, Zahir.
Thank you, Linda, and thanks, KBOO, for having me.
We've always appreciated what you have to say. Now, Dr. Wahab, in December, you were invited to write a commentary for the Eugene Register Guard, and you did. It was titled Afghan War, Failure on All Fronts. U.S. troop withdrawal from the political and military disaster cannot come soon enough. I've read your commentary, and then this past Sunday, I picked up the New York Times, and it had an article about a 3-year-old boy